All right, episode 22, let's get into it. Today, we have Mr. Richard Simon. Richard directs the website strategy at Georgetown Law in Washington, D.C., and is a former reporter and webmaster at Baltimore's The Daily Record. He lives in Baltimore with his wife and three children, and to this day, he leaves his smartphone off by default. His new book, Unplug, Richard shares what happens when you turn off your phone for a whole year. Yes, a whole year. Can you believe it? And through his story and others, from a chess grandmaster to a major league baseball player, you will learn how going phone-free transforms focus, relationships, and a peace of mind. You feel scattered, disconnected, or unmotivated? Don't worry, it might not be because you're lazy, but because your phone has hijacked your brain. In this episode, we dive deep into the hidden addiction nobody really talks about enough, your smartphone. Richard Simon turned his phone off for an entire year. Why? Because it was quietly wrecking his focus, relationships, and a sense of peace. We explore the real impact smartphones have on mental health, why 75 full days a year are wasted on screen time, and how modern life normalizes something that's deeply unnatural, being always available. You'll learn how to tell if you're addicted, why most hacks like screen time limits don't work, and what it really takes to reclaim your mind. If you've ever felt like your phone controls you more than you control it, this conversation will change how you look at your life and your time. By the end, you'll walk away with a blueprint to reset your relationship with technology, protect your focus, and start living just like you mean it. With that being said, before I execute the intro music, just give me a follow, do it, and rate the podcast. And now cue the music. You turned off your phone for a whole year. Why?
Like many people, I was spending hours on a device that was putting a strain on so many facets of my life. I mean, there was certainly the professional piece. So at work, I was having trouble focusing, accomplishing deep work, a text, a notification. I mean, in meetings, my ability to retain information just was not there. Relationships, I wasn't connecting as deeply with my wife as I would like to. We had two kids at the time when I was starting to think about this. Now we have three, but at the time I had two kids. I was 33, and I take them out to the zoo, the aquarium, various activities. And each time I do that, I'm just half there, but then I half wasn't. And then certainly in terms of relationships, in terms of friendships, so many of them were text-based. Like, there wasn't real conversation. It was just mere connection. And then there was myself. I wasn't able to connect with myself. Anytime there was an anxiety, a worry, a free moment, the constant companion model of the phone just came into play. And I wasn't able to really embrace solitude. So for all those reasons, I just felt like I needed to do something. And so often we hear about these hacks, these shortcuts in terms of how to establish a better relationship with our smartphone. So this could be deleting social media, a digital Sabbath, putting a rubber band around it, grayscale, airplane mode, and all those things are totally noble. But for something that's a true behavioral addiction, it just didn't go far enough. And that's why I decided to turn it off for the year.
How did you acknowledge that the lack of connection in your life was due to your phone?
Yeah, so first in terms of like friendships, I mean, my dearest friends, pretty much all we did was text. And I realized that there was just so much I was missing out on in terms of like my dear friends and their lives. And it was just so like superficial that ultimately when I did turn my phone off and texting was removed from the equation, for my dearest friends, we really had to invest in the relationship. Otherwise, it would fizzle. So let's say, for example, I'd have an average of 35 or 40 text message threads, let's say, in a given month with 35 to 40 different people. Well, many of those relationships, they did fizzle out as a result. But for the people who I cared about most in my life, we got that much closer as a result of turning off my phone. Now, in terms of my wife, it was a complete game changer. For people who have partners, they can very much relate to this. We would text throughout the day, me and my wife. And by the time we get home at night, there was nothing else to talk about because we literally had just like texted throughout the day. So when we'd get home from work, we would get really excited because, you know, we didn't totally waste that. We were able to like really be excited what happened today. Then after we put the kids to sleep, we would sit down together. And what would happen before I would turn my phone off is that we'd just be looking down at our phones. So we were together, but really not together. Take the smartphone out of the equation, we were able to connect on such a deeper level. So I realized before I went through all this and I was spending hours a day on my phone, I realized that, you know what, these connections that I thought were close, whether it be with my wife or with my dearest friends, they really weren't that close.
Mm. Yeah, I always think about, it's so funny, whenever I make plans with my friends, right, we say, all right, let's meet at this train station at 7 p.m. We get to the train station, and I know this is such a small detail, but I'm able to text them at 7 p.m., hey, where are you? Da, 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 da. And sometimes I actually have this thought where I go, Jesus, 30 years ago, when you had to make plans with someone, how on earth would you know if they had an emergency, if they were late? How would you get contact with them? And for me, that was like, holy, like, the phone is a lifesaver. But at the same time, that lack of spontaneousness or that lack of the surprising element can actually remove the personal human connection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's so funny you bring that up because I have various breakup styles in my book in terms of how to break up with your phone. And I have quit tips that are integrated in. And one of the quit tips I have is to recognize that you're the exception and just like be transparent in terms of like what you're embracing. Because what you just pointed out is that if you're meeting up with someone and guess what, like you don't have a smartphone or smartphone's turned off or whatever it might be, the other person who you're meeting up with will not be able to get in touch with you. But if you let that person know from the outset and you're clear, hey, just let you know, we're meeting up for coffee at Starbucks or whatever at, you know, 8 a.m. or 7 p.m. and something happens, then there's no way to get in touch with you. And it's interesting because in that sidebar, I profile a Fox News former Fox News host. He's now running for governor of California. This person is super, super connected. Like the more I was talking to him, I'm like, he's one of the most well-connected people like I've ever heard. And like he's interviewed a president in the Rose Garden, cabinet members. He has no smartphone. He doesn't carry any cell phone like with him. I said, like, how does that work? Like, have you ever gotten burnt? And he said, no, I don't get burned because what happens? I tell the person in advance, whether it's the senior aide of the political official or the media network or whatever, hey, like if we're going to be meeting at this time, I don't have a cell phone with me. So just to let you know, if something happens, you are not going to hear from me. And truthfully, in life, there really aren't that many instances and occasions where something like that happens. But as long as you set expectations, that's the most important piece.
And you know what? Now that you bring it up, it's so interesting. It's almost like because of our normality with our phones, we get annoyed at the fact when we don't have someone at our fingertips. I don't know about you, but I often, when I message someone on my phone and I don't get a reply for 4 hours, I'm like, what the hell? I asked for this 4 hours ago. Why am I not getting this reply now when I needed it 4 hours ago? But that's actually not a normal thing. It's not normal for people to just have someone at their fingertips constantly. We're not machines.
Oh, yeah. And on-call physicians. That is literally what you'd expect from an on-call physician, is that you get that message and you then return it within seconds or minutes. And yeah, it's completely unnatural. And yeah, it causes a lot of stress and anxiety for both people who send the messages and then people who are on the receiving end of the messages. There's also like an unpredictability. You don't know when that ding is going to come. You don't know when that message is going to come. And all of a sudden there's this urgency, or you feel this urgency. It's very anxiety provoking.
Yeah. Is it something like 75? Is that right? 75 days in a year we're using our phone?
Yeah, so the average American adult spends more than 5 hours a day on their smartphones. So added up over the course of the year, that's 75 days. And the average teen is more. It's 7 to 9 hours. And it's crazy. I mean, you know, there's many things in this world we don't know. But one thing's for sure, and that's a time on this earth is a finite, non-renewable resource. And if you come at it from the perspective that time on this earth is a finite, non-renewable resource, which is unequivocally clear, then you have to start analyzing, what am I doing with my time? And if it's truly 75 full days in a year, which is the median, which is literally right dab in the smack dab in the middle, 50th percentile, it's very concerning.
Yeah, 75 days in a year, and then you remove all the time that we're asleep. It's like half the time that we're conscious, we're looking at our hand, essentially. But let's get down to the crux of it. How do you know if you have an addiction?
Yeah, so dopamine is one of the most powerful molecules in the brain. And each time we reach for our phone and we tap it, which happens to the average person more than 150 times a day, it releases dopamine. That in of itself is an incredibly almost satisfying experience, because you want to satisfy that itch. So each time you press it, it releases dopamine, and the smartphone really is the ultimate shortcut machine. So over time, especially since the cell phone, it's progressed more and more from 2007 with Steve Jobs introducing the iPhone to the Moscone Center to literally to what we have today, it's become more and more of a shortcut machine. And we know it's a behavioral addiction because it is simply irresistible. You look around at the train station, 99.99% of people will be looking down at a phone. You go to a concert, 99% of people will be looking at their phones and their screens rather than at the actual musician. It is absolutely crazy. So, that really speaks to the behavioral addiction piece.
Is that the addiction part? The fact that when we have moments of boredom, we rely on our phones to satisfy the dopamine?
Yeah, absolutely. This is where definitely the moral panic piece, you know, comes in. There have been many moral panics in the past throughout time. And I've interviewed communications historians about this in terms of precedent. And we talked about television, comic books, radio. There have been all kinds of moral panics in the past. But what makes this moral panic so unique? And what makes this moral panic so unique is never before in human history has there ever been a time where we just can't be alone with our thoughts. We just can't. It's absolutely wild. We're in a waiting room at a doctor's office. Nobody's looking at a magazine. Everybody is looking down at a phone. When we're at the grocery store, it takes 3-4 minutes waiting in a line. Nobody can literally just stand there and just think. When we're in carpool line waiting for our kids at pickup, everyone is looking down at a phone. Every single person. Even just at 3 or 4 minutes, that time is critical. You might think, oh, what's 3 or 4 minutes? It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
No, our mind absolutely needs that time.
Why?
You know, when you're dealing with stress and when you're dealing with anxiety, you know, one of the most important things is for you to be able to compartmentalize those thoughts, to confront those emotions. If you're just going on CNN.com or NewYorkTimes.com, or you're going on TikTok or Instagram to sort of push aside those anxieties, you're not actually confronting them. You're not actually coming face to face with them. And that is so, so important, is to really feel actual emotions. If you're sad, that's okay. Let's say you break up with a girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever it might be, and you're really dealing with it. It's difficult. Like 30 years ago, you'd come back home and you'd cry. You'd cry. You get really vulnerable. If you're in college, and this is where I profiled a college student at Notre Dame, he broke up with his girlfriend. And he said if he still had a smartphone, he ended up breaking up with a smartphone. He still had a smartphone. He said he would have gone back to his dorm room and just like spend time on social media, just scrolling. But since he didn't have that ability, what did he do? He sat down in his dorm room futon for 10 minutes, felt awful. And what he decided to do was he went to his friend's dorm room and made himself completely vulnerable with his friends. His friends got to see him like in his most vulnerable state, and he said he never would have done that if he still had the smartphone. But that is so unbelievably important in terms of the recovery process, in terms of a breakup, is to feel those feelings. And if we literally just cover it up with the next TikTok video or the next Safari website you pull up on your iPhone, it's really a problem.
So this is an interesting piece. Is it the content we consume that is dangerous, or is it actually just being on the phone?
Oh, just being on the phone. I mean, you could be looking, just scrolling through photos in your photo library. You could be on a Substack, which could be more high quality content or however you want to call it. You could be in your email. You could be playing a mobile game. It doesn't really matter what the content is. The issue is that we're distracting ourselves from what we should really be doing, which is really confronting what we're going through, processing what we're going through. It's a really, really healthy thing to embrace that solitude. And that's one of the first things I heard from, I interviewed dozens of people who went through smartphone breakups. And that's one of the first things people experience is they feel withdrawal the first at least few days to 2 to 3 weeks after breaking up with their smartphones, after turning it off, because it, one, it's a behavioral addiction, but two, we're not comfortable enough in our own skin to be able to deal with that silence. It's absolutely wild.
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense, and especially in the long term, not long term, but long form, when we're sitting down and we need to just acknowledge our thoughts. Why is it important in these 4 minutes, these 2 minutes we're waiting for the elevator, these 2 minutes we're waiting for the train, these 2 minutes we're waiting at the hospital, to be so unplugged from our phone? Because you mentioned earlier, no one's looking at a magazine. What is the distinction between looking at a magazine and our phone when we're waiting for the doctor in the hospital's room?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that if you're reading something, that is a very low dopamine, but very high quality activity where you're processing ideas. You're confronting different ideas, whether it's reading a book or reading a magazine or a newspaper. And that can be therapeutic in of itself, doing something like that. There's also something in terms of embracing the analog and embracing something that's actually physical in terms of a physical magazine or newspaper or book that's also incredibly satisfying. But I do think, putting aside the book and the magazine, that it's really good, even if you're at a doctor's office, just to take 4 or 5 minutes and just to not think about anything. That's good. I encourage people, like, as one of the first steps before, as you're preparing for a smartphone breakup, is to go out for a walk for 45 minutes. Don't bring your smartphone with you. And for most people, they will freak out inside. Just absolutely freak out. Now, if you're, let's say, a female listener at NYU and there's a safety concern, okay, if you have a safety concern, turn your phone off. And if you really feel like for emergency reasons you need it, all right, just put it in your purse or back pocket or a backpack, but make sure it's in an off state. But in general, you can leave your smartphone behind in your dorm room or your house, whatever it might be. And when you go for it, the first few times it's going to be very, very unsettling what you're going through. But then you're all of a sudden going to like it. You're like, this is like my sacred time going for this 45-minute walk with literally no distractions. Now, of course, if you're in a place like you are, like New York City, there's plenty of things to look at, but the mind will wander, and that's a great thing.
You know, it's so funny. I feel like there's a distinct feeling of knowing what your phone feels like in your pocket at all times. And I don't know about you. Maybe it's, I mean, you're obviously different. When that phone isn't in my right pocket at that perfect weight, I have like a panic attack in a second. I'm like, hold on, where did I keep this thing? And it's so funny. It's probably back in my room, but I will literally panic for so long that my right pocket doesn't have the perfect weight in it.
Absolutely. People will go through crazy lengths if they lose their phone. Literally crazy, crazy lengths. It's absolutely unreal. I've been sent, ever since I started this journey 5 years ago, I've been sent some of the craziest stories of people who've done wild and wilder things of trying to figure out where their phones are if they lose them.
You know, I saw this challenge on social media a while ago. I think my friend shared it with me and he said we should do it. And I would love to. It's this challenge where you actually leave your phone at home, but you carry the case in your pocket. And you just do a challenge with your friend where you just see how many times you reach for the case Because I feel like sometimes we just subconsciously reach for the case without even us knowing, and you just tally how many times we reach for the case.
Yeah, and there's a mental piece to it too. I mean, you know, there are studies that show that if you're at a restaurant, and even if you have your phone in a bag, even if you have your phone face down on a table, there's this mental piece where you're just still thinking about it. And it, that impacts just the conversation. It's wild how dependent we become on them.
Yeah, and I saw this, I'm sure you know Jonathan Haidt. He's actually an NYU professor. He came out with The Anxious Generation. I was lucky enough to go to a talk. In the 1 hour talk, this sounds such a weird statistic to bring up, but the one statistic that absolutely blew my mind was the fact that my generation of young men, Gen Z, is the first ever generation where our fathers are more likely to break a bone than we are. And I thought that's crazy, because you expect children to be the most vulnerable to injuries and breaking bones. But because we're so reliant on our digital realm, we aren't doing the things that typically would turn us into men. And our fathers are now more prone to breaking a bone.
That's absolutely wild. Wow. Yeah, his work, his research has been tremendous because, and this is me coming from the parenting side, parents had really felt helpless up until his book came out. The truth is that everything that Jonathan Haidt, you know, espouses in terms of anxious generation, and he proves in terms of his research, it's something that parents didn't already believe and know. If you would tell a parent the week before John Haidt's book came out, is it smart for a kid to have a smartphone? Is it smart for there to be phones in school? The majority of parents would say, no, like that's a really bad idea. But you needed an authoritative figure like John Haidt to come across and say, no, this is the research that points to it being a bad idea. And all of a sudden parents are like, all right, we have something that we're equipped with. And I think really that's a really good first step. But I think the next step in where we're at right now is that what do we do as adults? And what I mean by that is that what kind of behavior are we modeling for our kids? Okay, so great. Our seventh grader or eighth grader is in school and there's no phones. That's wonderful. But what happens when they come out of school? And most people I see, seventh and eighth graders that come out of school, they turn on their smartphones. But if we, let's say, for example, say they don't have a smartphone and they get into the car with their parent, and the parent's looking down at the phone. And they get back home, and at the kitchen table, the parent is looking down at the phone. And then in bedroom, they see their parents just looking down at their phones. What kind of behavior are we modeling for our kids? And there are studies that show that if you're a parent who smokes cigarettes, even though cigarettes aren't allowed in the schools, which is absolutely correct, they should not be allowed in the schools, but if they're constantly exposed to cigarette use, they will be much more inclined to be cigarette smokers. It is so unbelievably important for us as parents to be setting the right example. And I think really that is the next step that has to be tackled. And I'm hoping with my book, that's something that, you know, parents can really start thinking more critically about.
Yeah. And it's my favorite part. Gen Z, what can we do? You did it for a whole year. You did cold turkey. Do we have to do cold turkey to break up with our phone?
Yeah, so I mentioned the shortcuts and the hacks. They just don't cut it. And I think that that goes across for every age group, background, geographic location. It doesn't matter. And that's one thing I found from the dozens of interviews I conducted. Interviewed and profiled a Major League Baseball player, one of the top 10 chess players in the country, college student, space engineer, graphic designer, people from all over the world, on-call anesthesiologist. And what I found was that it doesn't matter where you are in life, the first step to establishing a more effective relationship with your smartphone is to turn it off. And in terms of college students, I ended up profiling three different college students in terms of what they did in college to reset the relationships that they have with their smartphones. And yeah, happy to explore those. One I'll just bring up right away, which is I think one that will likely resonate most with your listeners, is I interviewed a college student at Notre Dame who his smartphone was just similar to me, putting a strain on many facets of his life. And what he ended up doing was his sophomore year at Notre Dame, he ended up switching from a smartphone to the most basic of basic phones. He basically got like an Alcatel like flip phone that he got like for like $20 at Target. And really with these kinds of flip phones, like the Alcatel TCL Flip, I mean, really all they can do is call and text. Like there are more, there are other basic phones like the Lite phone, like the Wise phone, like the Gab that have many more features. But for the sake of the detox, and I recommend at least 60 days to reset the reward pathways in your brain, to turn off your phone, and I mentioned four different breakup styles. For this instance, Josh Haskell is his name, the Notre Dame student. He embraced the style that I call simplifying your phone. He switched to an Alcatel flip phone. And for him, like everything changed and in terms of his collegiate career. And I'll speak about one aspect of it. There are many aspects to speak of, but one aspect I think will resonate deeply with your audience and college students is that Josh talked about how, you know, you think in college that if you turn to a basic phone, that you'll be much more isolated. Like, you won't be as integrated. You won't be as much on social media as much in terms of groups and all that stuff. And the way he described it was that he realized that he was wasting his appetite on social media in terms of his friendships. Like, he would always come into a conversation with some sort of bias coming in. He called it a bias because he knew whether it was someone who he hadn't met before, he looked them up beforehand, or he would be friends with people, but he would see what they'd be posting on social media. Oh, this is what I did for spring break. He already knew about everything that was going on. Mm. So he said he had so much more social energy. And he said, you know, people would be texting back and forth about various functions, whatever it might be. And he said he really had to seek out, you know, relationships. So for him, he wasn't texting with people. So he legitimately wanted to go to the dining hall with whoever. And he would spend time with them in the dining hall. And for social gatherings, whatever it might be, like, he didn't waste that appetite through texting and through social media. It was all much more in real life. And I thought that was incredible. There was another couple I interviewed who were maintaining a long-distance relationship. She was in college in Leeds in the UK, and he was in college in Northern Ireland. Long-distance relationship. The breakup style they did is one of the four I talk about is called basically breaking up with someone else, like quitting with someone else. So basically quit your smartphone with either a partner, a spouse, a family member. It creates this extra sense of accountability. In any event, they broke up with their phones together. They turned their smartphones off. They went to basic phones. And you think, how on earth in this day and age are you able to maintain a long-distance relationship without smartphones? Well, what they did was, instead of texting each other and sending each other emojis throughout the day, they spent time 1 to 2 times a week talking for 3 to 4 hours. So for them, like, there was this stress. We talked about it earlier, like, you're not sure when the next text is going to come in. You're in class, and you're not sure when that buzz is going to happen from your girlfriend who's over in the UK. All right, now there's predictability. Now you know on Sunday and, let's say, Wednesday in the evening, we're going to carve out 3 to 4 hours where we are literally going to talk about everything. And they said they discovered things about each other they didn't even know. And they had been dating since they were in high school. And I thought that was absolutely incredible. So those are just two quick insights. I don't want to monopolize all the time about just, conversation and relationships when it comes to doing this in college. But I found it to be just very, very powerful.
Yeah, the lack of availability through the digital world actually enhances the physical conversation when it comes because of its rarity almost.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And then on the academic side, and this is really cool. So I interviewed one of the top 10 chess players in the world.
Yeah.
His name is Wesley So. He grew up in the Philippines and he got a scholarship at Webster University in St. Louis. It's one of the top chess programs. They had just started their chess program at the time. And his chess was really good, but it wasn't at the level, the elite status he wanted to get to. He was trying to figure out a formula on what he could do just to be more focused in terms of his chess and his academics. So he found the secret. And this is like, I thought this was just like a secret weapon for a college student. He, in his dorm room at Webster, now with the, this is in 2014, 15, with Wi-Fi, it's a little trickier. But yeah. Basically, he turned off internet in his dorm room. He turned off his phone, his smartphone. And basically, what that meant was that in order to do any work, he'd have to go to the library. And so he did all of his academic work in the library. And then for his chess in his dorm room, he had no distractions. His smartphone was off. He had no internet access in his dorm room. And he was spending 3 to 4 hours of uninterrupted time accomplishing deep work. And he all of a sudden realized that that was his secret. And deep work is really difficult. Like, if you want to concentrate uninterrupted, even for 30 to 45 minutes, it's like a muscle in the brain. Like, you have to train it. So it took time. It took him months to get to this period. Anyway, eventually I'll go right to what happened. He ended up advancing to number 2 in the world. He won the Millionaire Chess Open in Las Vegas and ended up quitting Webster and turning professional. But really, that was his secret. Same thing with Josh Haskell in Notre Dame. Like, his grades weren't bad when he was a college student, but it wasn't at the level that he wanted it to be. He talked about going to the library with his smartphone. He would put it in his backpack. He thought that was the secret. All right, I'll put my smartphone in my backpack and that'll be it. But he talked about this mental struggle. I think we spoke about it a little bit earlier. This mental struggle, the phone's in his backpack. He's thinking about what's coming in, what text, whatever it might be, and it would still be a distraction. Anyway, he gets rid of his smartphone, and he achieves this level of focus when he's at the library that he's never achieved before because he's not worried about what text is coming in. He's not worried about what notification might be coming up. He's fully focused on his work. Anyway, he ends up becoming valedictorian of the Notre Dame graduating class in 2024. He achieved this level of focus in terms of his academics that he literally had not achieved before that point, and I thought that was just incredible. So I think for college students, there's something very powerful about this in terms of the secret weapon with the smartphone or getting rid of the smartphone.
You know what I'm actually most amazed by? The fact that they didn't find a cheap alternative. Because, I'll be honest, there was a week in, I think, April where I got, I think the app was called Opal or something, where it like limits your screen time and just blocks it off. Mm. And my screen time was actually not bad. I think it was like an hour a day, so not bad. The issue is, I was on my computer the entire day. Like, the alternatives in the current digital landscape is infinite. Because you turn off your phone, okay, let's get a Nokia in. Well, the MacBook that you need for class or you need for work is sitting right there. And guess what? If you want to pop an Instagram, you can right away. How do you work around the alternatives?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. Yeah, so I have a sidebar in the book on high dopamine replacement activities. So one of the first things that happens when you turn off your smartphone, once again, I go through 4 different breakup styles in the book, so different approaches, but when you first turn off your smartphone, your brain is going to crave high dopamine replacement activities. Now, for some people, that's other things, not a computer, like video games, but for most people, it's really a computer. Now, of course, when you leave your dorm room or you leave your house, thankfully, for the most part, that stays there, either in your backpack or it's and back in your dorm or in your house. So thankfully, when you're outside of the house, that's taken care of. But what happens when you're back in your dorm room or in your house? So I talk about how important it is to resist the urge in terms of high dopamine replacement activities when you turn your smartphone off. So in terms of how to do this, I'll talk about a couple of things. One is that you can shape your living arrangement in a way where high dopamine replacement activities are limited to a specific place. So if you live in a house, and I'll get to dorm room, if you have a house, you make sure that screens stay in a specific place in the house. So for example, kitchen and dining room. No screens go there because that will signal to your mind it's a place for eating. No screens come into the bedroom because that signals to your brain it's a place for sleeping. Your den, screens don't come in there because it signals to your brain, I'm going to do high quality leisure activities here, whether it's board games, whether it's reading, whatever it might be. So you have a specific section in the house for screens, and it also adds this extra friction. Okay, I've turned my smartphone off. I'm craving a high dopamine replacement activity. Resist the urge. Now I have to go all the way down to the basement, and there's like a room in that basement that has all of those things. Do I have to go down to the basement and then have to go on and then I have to turn on the computer to do that? It's not worth it. I'm staying up here. Okay, so what do you do if you're in a dorm room? This all sounds great in terms of a house. What do you do if you're in a dorm room? All right, this might sound crazy. This is what I recommend. All right, so you're in a, whatever, let's say a studio, not even a one bedroom, not even a two bedroom. You're in a studio apartment or you're in a studio dorm. You're in all the same space. What I would recommend is creating a tent.
Sorry, what?
A tent. Either you can put sheets up or you can get an actual tent. You put in your room. You're limited with space. I don't know what the square footage is of an average NYU dorm, but it's probably not much space. The best you're probably going to do is a tent or some sheets. And what I would recommend is that within that tent or within those sheets, that's where you do your quality work, your quality thinking or meditation, your, whether it's sleep, whatever it is, anything that is not screen dependent happens in that space. So if you basically say, all right, I need to get to work, like I need to study, I have this textbook or whatever for work, the computer's staying at the desk, you're going inside the tent, you're going into the place where the sheets are. Let's say you're a music major at NYU, whatever it is. All right, you're going with your saxophone and your music theory sheets, and you're going into the tent or around the sheets, and that is where the deep work is done. I think that is the most elegant solution I can think of when you're creating a space when you have limited square footage. It might sound ridiculous and it might sound silly. Your friends might make fun of you and think that you're weird, that you created this weird sheet arrangement that you've taped to the wall and everything like that. But you just tell them, no, like this is where my deep work is done. Now, in terms of the computer itself, you bring the computer, let's say, into the tent because you have to type up a paper. You have a 20-page paper that's due the next week or the next morning, whatever it might be. You're going to pull an all-nighter. How are you going to pull this off? All right, so the best thing you can do is use the tent still, bring the computer in, but just go offline. Go offline and use the most discipline you can use because you know that you're in your deep work space and only deep work happens in this space and you have to go offline. That's really the only solution to getting around the urges you'll have to check social media on your computer or whatever it might be. But since you're in that deep work space, you're in the tent, and you know this is the place where you read, this is the place where you do deeper activities, it'll signal to yourself, okay, I'm in the tent, I'm in my deep workspace. And if you have a roommate, you'll know there's accountability there. Hey, I see you on Facebook, or I see you on Instagram, get off that. There might be some accountability there too if you have a roommate or friends who can check in.
Yeah. Where do you use your phone in your house right now?
Yeah, so I talk about four breakup styles in the book. The style that I embrace is called the off-by-default philosophy.
Okay.
So for the year that I had my smartphone off, what I basically did was I had it off, but I didn't get rid of it. And basically, the definition of the off-by-default philosophy in the context of the detox and having the phone breakup is you only turn it on if there is a critical task, meaning an emergency, that has to be where you need your phone. So, for example, you're at the zoo, the kid falls off a ledge and needs to be taken to urgent care. All right, turn your smartphone on and call your wife up. You don't want them to be worried sick. Let's say you have terrible food poisoning or whatever it might be, or there's a public safety concern and you're at NYU and you need to call public safety. All right, turn your smartphone on in that moment if you're embracing the off-by-default philosophy. But truthfully, there aren't that many real emergencies in life. And the perfect example is I had my phone off for 12 months because I didn't have any actual emergencies. But for my wife and for people in my family, you know, they really appreciated the fact that I had it. I just didn't turn it on. You know, I interviewed and profiled an on-call anesthesiologist in the book who, you know, his life is life and death situations. And he's an on-call physician at one of the top research hospitals in the country, Johns Hopkins. And he needs a work smartphone. He needs it. But when he leaves his practice at the hospital, he leaves it plugged in. And he doesn't use a personal smartphone. So how does he get alerted when there's an emergency? He doesn't have a two-way pager. No, he has a one-way pager. I told him, I said, that's really wild. Like, isn't your wife worried? Like, if there's an emergency? And he said, Richard, I'm an anesthesiologist, and I can tell you there aren't that many real emergencies in life. So anyway, that's basically how I framed it for my detox. And I interview and profile people in the book, a law partner and also a writer who also embraced this off-by-default philosophy. But what happens to the off-by-default philosophy after the detox is over? So after my year was complete, what did I do? I knew I didn't want to have my phone on all the time. Like, it was, the year was so great. But what I did know is that there were certain moments during the year where the smartphone would have enhanced my life. So I still embrace the off-by-default philosophy to this day. but I altered the definition. And the definition of the all five by default philosophy can be changed after the detox to, you only turn on your smartphone for something that will enhance your life. So my smartphone always stays off in an off state, but there's something I need to do that will enhance my life. I turn it on. So for example, 2 days ago, we went to beautiful gardens outside of Philadelphia called Longwood Gardens. We hit traffic. I turned my phone on, GPS to navigate around the craziness of the traffic. And what do we do when we get to Longwood Gardens? I turned it off. Even after everything that I had been through, if I still had my smartphone on at Longwood Gardens and it was in my pocket, I would feel that urge and I'd want to check it. And I do not want to do that when I'm with my wife and when I'm with my kids. So it is in an off state when it's in my pocket. So all of a sudden, with the off by default philosophy, I'm in control of it rather than it being in control of me.
Okay. You know what? I liked everything you've just said. I have a one small tweak for you, all right? So use your phone only when it enhances your life. The issue I have is, I feel like a lot of us, and I think you have great discipline, you can do it. A lot of us will find any excuse to say, yeah, our phone use right now is going to enhance our life. Can we get a concrete definition of what enhancing our life is?
Oh, yeah. I should say first, I don't have good discipline. I absolutely don't have good discipline.
Well, you were able to go for a year, so I think you do.
I am just as distractible as literally anyone, which is why I needed the detox. But what happens after the detox is that it recalibrates the reward pathways in your brain. If you would just try the off-by-default approach with the latter definition of just doing it, having it off and only turning it on to enhance your life, you're going to be turning it on all the time.
Yeah.
But when you detox from it and have it off for at least 60 days, it completely recalibrates the reward pathways in your brain. So you only know, you'll know those instances when you absolutely need it. I'll have it off for days at a time, sometimes weeks in certain circumstances where I won't have it on. But the only reason why I don't turn it on is because I know how good it feels to have it off. And I know the consequences when I turn it on. If I didn't detox and go through that whole process, I wouldn't be at the point where I am right now. So yeah, no, if you would embrace that approach today, Rishi, if you tonight say, I'm going to turn my phone off, embrace off by default, only turn it on to enhance my life, I think you are really going to struggle with it. But if you start off with the detox, which is incredibly challenging in of itself, but if you start off with the detox, you need preparation first. You definitely need to prepare for the detox. But if you go through that detox and then you come out on the other side, you are going to be in control of it.
Yeah, do you think 60 days is the minimum we need for a detox? Or should we start smaller and then slowly amp it up? Because a lot of us are addicted to our phones.
And that's the importance in terms of the 60 days. Like, why 60 days? Why not 30 days as an example? I say 60 because almost everyone I interviewed went through withdrawal.
Yeah.
Almost everyone. And most people, it's a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. And what happens is that when you turn off your phone, you're going to regain hours of time that you didn't have before. And that's really, really scary. Like if you average, whatever, five and a half hours, like the average American, or if you're a teen and you average 7 to 9, all of a sudden you remove the smartphone from the environment, you embrace one of these four breakup styles, it's really scary. I mean, like, what are you going to do? I mean, one screen addiction expert told me, like, it can even be a matter of life and death in terms of what you're going to do, because some people are so dependent on it that they literally could become depressed, they could become suicidal. If you don't have replacement activities for all of those hours that are now free in the day, you're gonna run into trouble, which is why the preparation piece is so unbelievably key. And I talk about in the book, you know, how as you're preparing for the detox, you're establishing a support group, how important it is to get a physical piece of paper, establish categories at the top of the paper, your value buckets, community, athletics, charity, whatever it might be, and within each one of those buckets, establish activities. It could be going to church twice a week, joining this book club, read for 45 minutes each day, meditation for 10 minutes each morning. And what you do is you put it on your fridge or put it in a really good place, share it as a Google Doc if you want to increase accountability, and that's your menu. So all of a sudden, when you got free time, which you're going to have hours of it, you're going to say, oh, let me go to the menu. And you pick your thing off the list. And those are the things that you focus on.
Okay, so this is what I struggle with a lot, right? I think especially me in the podcasting world, in the content creation world, nowadays we get rewarded for using our phones. And I mean, for example, an hour ago, I was on call with Anthony Gross. He's a content creator, one of my favorite content creators. The type of content he makes is he does day in the lives every day. And I know that content creation, for example, is amping up. And even the ability to create content with your phone has never been easier. The issue is we get rewarded with that ability to create content. So we need that phone on. How can we work around that?
Yeah, so I'll mention two things. So one is that I interviewed a writer from Vermont who has a really good social media following, but the social media was really putting a lot of stress in her life, and she decided to embrace the off-by-default philosophy. So how does that work? As literally, this is your career, and she's literally established this whole social media following. How does that work in terms of when a phone comes out of the environment? So she went through this in the preparation phase, and what she realized was that, if she invested several hours a week to YouTube, producing at least 1 to 2 high-quality YouTube videos a week, and the rest of the week is literally spent on her craft in terms of writing, she realized that could be the formula that could work. So before, she was checking literally notifications all the time. She was posting all the time to Instagram and to Facebook and to YouTube. And it was just constant. And the barrage of messages she was getting was constant. She's like, you know what? Like, if I just carve out 3 to 4 hours each week for this and focus my time on YouTube, I think it could make a huge difference in terms of my writing, but also in terms of like my actual social media use, because people will be getting higher quality content. Before you know it, she has over 40,000 followers on YouTube. And these videos she produces, you can look her up. She's an amazing writer. And what she does on social media, these YouTube videos are great. Her name's Kate Emmons. And she figured out how she could really make social media work for her and for her to achieve levels of depth that she couldn't imagine possible. I also interviewed and profiled a social media strategist who, this is her life, social media. It's like all she does. So how does she make it work being a social media strategist and also having broken up with her phone? She's a basic phone personally. Well, she uses social media and does the whole hyperactive hive mind from 9 to 5. She's on it all the time. And then what happens when she leaves her office? Her business phone stays there, and she's able to separate her personal and business footprints entirely. She knows she has to use a smartphone. Like, that's a reality for her business, reality for her work. Just like the anesthesiologist, where it's life and death issues. He absolutely needs a smartphone. It's a reality. It could be an electrician. It could be a roofer. They might need a smartphone for whatever reason. But why would you want to carry that all the way over into your personal life as well?
Aha. It's actually cutting out the spontaneous usages of our phone and rather planning it. Because planning it, at least, allows us to live freely in the moments around it, almost. I guess, like, if we plan it, it's almost like that is the work that enhances our life.
Absolutely. And if Kate knows, and there's that predictability, I'm going to spend a half day per week. And let's say it's Monday morning. All right, that Monday morning, that has the half day a week where I'm investing all my time and energy into social media, responding to comments, spending time. Okay, great. But then she focuses the rest of the week on her craft. I think it's a tremendous idea.
Okay, so, Richard, if I were to start a detox right now with this little thing, how do I prep?
So, a lot depends on the approach, but let's say, for example, you're going to go basic phone. Rishi is going to go with an Alcatel flip phone, just wants to spend $20, switch over a SIM card, you're going to keep the same number, you're going to go with that approach. So, that's the easiest approach by far, is to switch over to a basic phone and keep the SIM card. It's still challenging, but definitely, since you're still technically available to people, it's much less of a barrier to cross. You're going to want to get people who are in your inner circle involved in terms of this process. I don't know who's in your inner circle. It could be dear friends from school. It could be family. You're going to want people on your side. They're going to think you're crazy for what you're doing, but you're going to want to have them as a support group. Bring in the emotional piece. Say, hey, look, this is for my mental health. This is absolutely what I need. If there are certain applications that you use in terms of school or whatever it might be, reach out to your university. I work for Georgetown University in DC. And in order to get to an academic building, you put up your smartphone.
Yeah.
Well, I told them, I don't have, you know, my smartphone's off. I don't use it, like, for that reason. What happened? They gave me a physical card. So I use the physical card to get in and out of buildings, so I don't have to use my smartphone to get in and out of buildings. You have to anticipate those things. If there's dual authentication, how does dual authentication work if I can't use, you know, Duo or whatever your dual authenticator is on your phone? Well, I let the IT department know. What did the IT department tell me? Oh yeah, you can use your fingerprint. Use a Mac? Sure. Use a PC? Here's a fob. You want to go to a New York Knicks game. You say, no, I want to see the Knicks, but you know what? SeatGeek, it requires me to have, you know, my phone and the app and everything like that. Well, actually, if you go to guest services, they'll actually give you a physical ticket. And then you can get to bring a physical ticket. And the nice thing is, then you have a keepsake. When I was growing up, we went to Orioles games. Like, I loved collecting the tickets. I still have them, like all of my physical tickets from when I was growing up. You know, the person I interviewed for the book, he's a huge Nuggets fan. He's a pastor in Denver. And he told me he switched to a basic phone. He's like, what am I going to do with Nuggets games? This is crazy. And he found out the same thing, is that as long as you print out, like, your, you know, ticket and your receipt, and you bring it to the counter, they'll actually physically give you a ticket and you get to bring it in. And like, oh, how cool is that? Like, that's awesome. Like the good old days. So anyway, you'd be surprised how integrated and baked into the modern day economy the smartphone is. Like, you can still survive. You can still make it. And let's say, for example, there's a financial transaction or financial institution, and you say, you know what, like, it is becoming too much of a pain, like, to not have the smartphone. All right, so you can still have your smartphone. Turn on your smartphone. If it's connected to Wi-Fi in your dorm room, there's not much you can do without a SIM card in terms of connecting with people, but you can still do whatever, financial transaction, do your Venmo or whatever it is. I mean, you can use Venmo on a computer, but you can turn it on, make the financial transaction, and then turn it off. So, plan for that as much as possible, those instances. If you have a Chase account and you log in and the way you authenticate is through text, switch it to email. Go through those steps first so you don't feel like you get burnt later on.
Yeah, you know, maybe I'm just soft, but as a beginner, that may seem like a bit of a challenge for me. Like, it's, you know what it is? It's not the challenge to be off the phone because I want to go on Instagram or anything. It's because so much of the life around me, if it's, for example, for me to get into my apartment right now, one of the things is, oh, I could use my phone to open the door. I've got a key, but the easiest way is open the door. That kind of detail, fine. Like, I can use a key. But even, like, the bigger stuff where you're talking about, oh, I got to go to a stadium, that extra bit of resistance that can pile on, it sounds terrible.
And in the sense of the detox, you know, change is really, really hard. And we're so used to these shortcuts. Like, we want to go into YouTube and I want to listen to a 2-minute Peter Attia or Andrew Huberman clip just to get that, like, 2 minutes. And, like, that's what people want. They want that bite-sized content. But it's not how it works in terms of transforming your life. When it comes to transforming your life, it takes doing something that's hard. That's really, really hard. It's just like exercise and building muscle. If you tell me, Rishi, that you're going to the gym for 3 weeks, and you're like, why am I not ripped? It's like Andrew Huberman is or whatever it is. It's like, yeah, because you spent 3 weeks on it. And ultimately, to do something really, really hard, it takes effort. So too with reestablishing how you do deep work, your relationships, in terms of investing in yourself, it takes a lot of hard work, and it's not as simple as just meditating for 5 minutes in the morning or doing ab crunches for like 3 weeks. Like, it's about real, real effort. And yeah, this is everything we're talking about is incredibly, incredibly challenging to do. But I'm telling you, from the other side and from interviewing dozens of people, it's really worth it.
What is the best way that you've seen where we can ensure commitment? Because what I've noticed from this thing is, or this unplug and detox is, it's one of those where you can only do it if you really want it. And so, because this is a mental challenge, if our brain sometimes is struggling to overcome this mental challenge, It's hard to think yourself out of a thinking problem. Is there is there actual extra tips we can build so that we can build an environment that allows us to ensure commitment even when our mind is struggling?
Yeah. Accountability is a really big deal. So if you're able to do it with a roommate or a dear friend and you're in it together, that's very effective. And the other one thing I would bring up is I would invest in it financially. I'm not talking like any sort of like crazy like investment, but I would invest in it financially. And here are a few examples of things you could do. Invest in a physical camera. You might say, that's like ridiculous. Like, why would I want to invest in a physical camera? Okay, well, not only will it ultimately redefine how you take photos, instead of taking like 60 photos of like the same thing, you'll be more intentional with it. What ultimately happens is that when you invest in the process financially, ultimately it'll signal to your brain that this matters. Like, you hear about this from people like who like quit sugar. Like, how are they able to effectively quit sugar? They'll start buying $8 a box Magic Spoon cereal that has no sugar. It pains them to go to the grocery store to spend $8 on the sugar-free cereal. That's whatever, $8, not a huge deal in the grand scheme of things. But when you know you're spending $2 on cereal and you're spending $8 on cereal instead, it signals to your brain, I'm actually getting serious about this. And I know that if I eat this sugary food, I'm wasting my money on the last $40 delivery I got on 5 boxes of sugar-free cereal. So too with this detox. Invest in a physical camera. Another example is, invest in a newspaper, a print newspaper during your detox. Do it for the 2 months or the 3 months, however long you decide to do your detox for. News consumption is going to change tremendously when you get off your smartphone. Tremendously. Now, we're just used to like feeling like we're members of the State Department and like needing to be in the know constantly. Like, I'm going to check NewYorkTimes.com. I'm going to check CNN.com. I'm going to check FoxNews.com. Whatever your source of information is, you're constantly checking it. Like, you're literally like a member of like the United States Embassy. No. Like, the only people who benefit from that are the social media sites or the news sites where you're gathering that content. If you invest in a physical newspaper and you set up a routine of, okay, I'm going to have breakfast in the dining hall and I'm going to have my physical newspaper, people think I'm absolutely insane. But you're, once again, signaling to your brain, I'm taking this detox seriously. I've got my physical camera that I got from B&H in Brooklyn, and I've got my physical newspaper of the New York Times, the New York Post, or whatever, however you lean politically. You've got that like in the dining room. You're like, all right, I'm taking this seriously. We're not talking thousands of dollars. We're talking about 100 to 200 bucks, whatever it is. But like, it really is something that's powerful.
Now that is really, really smart, I think. That is really good. Investing in it is actually really intelligent. I spoke to my ex-trainer, who is in the military, and he does a lot of... he's a personal trainer, and I spoke to him on the podcast, and I was one of his clients that obviously sometimes cancel on him, and he was speaking to me that saying, Rish, I had so many 6 a.m. sessions where clients would just not wake up in time and cancel. And his solution was, if you're going to work out with me, the workout sessions are not reliant on pay by hour anymore. It's a prepay system.
Oh, yeah.
So he now made all of his clients basically go, all right, if you want 20 sessions with me, you're paying it now. And the rate of participation went up crazy. And plus the bonuses. Well, if the client doesn't show up, guess what? He's already got the money. Well, that's a financial thing. But the thing is, by actually investing in it already, you've already taken the costs of participating in this challenge.
Oh yeah. No, that makes total sense. Yeah, no, if I were paying money up front for my training session, yeah, I would get up at 5:20 no matter what to make sure I was there, be there at 6 o'clock on the dot, because that's what money does when you invest in it. Like, you need to go.
And one of actually, on even a different way, I think one of the things that keeps me going, I bring this up every single time. If anyone's listening, they're probably going to kill me because I bring it up all the time. My initial goal was, when I started this podcast, was to hit 20 podcasts. So what I did was, I hit 20 podcasts 2 days ago. Pretty nice.
Congratulations.
But, thank you. Means a lot, Richard. But what one of the biggest things that was motivating me is, right here, awfully, it's not on screen, but maybe I can put in a photo. I've got sticky notes on my walls, and one of them says Road to 20 Podcasts. And for every podcast I do, I put a sticky note up on my wall. Mm. The reason that works, and where I got that idea was from was Atomic Habits, James Clear. And it's the visual representation that allows me to give credit for myself. I think giving credit for yourself in a challenge per day that you haven't used your phone might be really motivating.
Absolutely. Those rewards are huge. Yeah, I interview and profile someone who actually lives in New York City, who's a user experience designer. And that's something that he did when he was going through his detox. He switched to a basic phone and he put up on the door of his room basically a chart and tracker in terms of all the things that he was doing and sought out to do in terms of reading metrics, in terms of mindfulness metrics, in terms of exercise and walking metrics. And all those things were up on the door. So he knew, all right, I'm getting hours back every single day. This is what I'm investing in. And he had a physical representation for it. That's when I wrote the book, what did I do for accountability? When you sign a book contract with a publisher, you have a certain number of months to write it. So how are you held accountable in terms of writing it? Well, for me, it was putting up on a board in our kitchen so that everyone could see it, my wife or anyone else who walked in, our kids, like our oldest, who's old enough to count, he could count along, and I would put up word count. How many words did I write each day? And everyone could see it, and I was held accountable. That was a really, really big motivator.
Yeah, and I often wonder, right, because I saw this this idea spewed out the other day, and I fall into this trap. I'm a very all-or-nothing guy. When I do something, I put my all into it. But the con of that is when I slip, I slip. How can we make sure that when we slip with our phones, whether it's, oh shit, I just used YouTube for 30 minutes, the challenge is over, I can go back to using YouTube. How do you make sure that doesn't happen?
Yeah. So I have a whole chapter in the book about reintegration, because you're not going to slip during the detox. I'm being serious. You're not going to slip during the detox. I have full faith in you that you're not going to slip. But, what happens ultimately when you're done with your detox and you're slipping again? That is completely, completely natural. And there's no worries in terms of doing another detox. Like, you can do another detox. That is very common in terms of many different substances, whether it is a smartphone addiction, an alcohol addiction, a cigarette addiction, gambling addiction. Slipping is something that is very, very common. And for smartphones, it's particularly tricky because in some, you know, ways, and this is what I did with mine, is, you know, you're turning it on more, so it can be easier to slip. I definitely encourage folks, after they've done a detox and they reintegrate the phone, if they find themselves slipping, definitely don't hesitate to do another detox, whether it's the same breakup style or choose a different style. So let's say, for example, you did off by default. Instead, you want to say, you know what, I want to instead get a basic phone. Do that. Let's say you did a basic phone, say, I want to try something else. How about getting rid of it altogether? Let's say you got rid of it altogether and then you brought in the smartphone again and it didn't work. Well, how about you go and reach out to a spouse or a girlfriend and say, hey, can we do this together? It's okay to detox more than once. The smartphone is incredibly addictive, just like gambling is incredibly addictive. It's okay to have lapses. I encourage additional detoxes.
Richard May, I don't have a girlfriend. What are you doing to me? What are you doing? You're hurting me personally right there. But that's on a separate note. Richard, can I just say, it's been an absolute pleasure, but I always wanted to ask this because since your detox, I've been fascinated with what your actual day looks like now. Because if you were to ask me, consumer technology, what does your typical day look like now?
Yeah, so I am a technology professional. I do need technology for my work at Georgetown. So for my work day, I am in front of the computer a lot. But in terms of smartphone use, my smartphone is almost never on. If you were to look at my average screen time, which, you know, my wife encouraged me to do before the publication of my book, you know, my average screen time looks like anywhere from 1 minute to 3 minutes per day.
What? You are joking.
Yeah, I know. That's what happens. That's the power of detox. And that's the power of this process, is that I am investing time in the things that really matter. It's absolutely wild. I mean, I'll give you an example today. I took my kids with my wife to Hershey Park. If you're familiar with Hershey Park is a very fun amusement park. And there were all kinds of emails. My book came out yesterday, all kinds of emails going on. And I knew all those emails were going on. If I had my smartphone on at Hershey Park, I would have been zero, not 1%, 0% present with what was going on. And what happened when I got to my computer? I saw tons of messages, and there were a couple that were like, hey, we're waiting for you to confirm this interview for this television station for next week. Please confirm as soon as possible. You know what? That's just how it is. I responded to it right before we got on. It was probably 8 hours later than they wanted it to be, but that's okay. That's just how it is. So at any rate, that is what my smartphone use looks like right now in terms of an average day, is that there are some days I don't turn it on, and if I do turn it on, I accomplish what I need quickly, and then I immediately, no lag, I immediately turn it off. Similar to a TV. You wouldn't leave your TV on all the time. After you watch your Netflix show, after you watch the Pacers-Knicks game, whatever it might be, you turn it off after you're finished. Now, it could be in disgust if you're a Knicks fan, but you turn it off right after you're done.
Yeah, you're gaining your power back, essentially. Because even the fact that, oh, you're 8 hours behind, well, it's you can't expect someone, just because you have someone's contact, it's funny that we have a predisposition of an expectation that they must succumb to our expectations because we have them at our fingertips.
Yeah. And Rishi, I mean, the thing is that the power of preparation is that, you know, the reason why this works in terms of relationships, me having my smartphone off, is that all the people I care about, you know, friends, family, colleagues, they know that my smartphone isn't on. Like, they know. So they know if they want to get in touch with me, they have certain paths to doing that. So for my dearest friends and family, they have my landline, they have my work phone, they have email. There are so many ways to get in touch with me that are so much more than we even had even 20 years ago. I'm so unbelievably reachable. So there are those paths. Now, if you were just to go cold turkey right now without letting people know, that would probably be really offensive to people in your world. They'd be like, oh my gosh, like he literally went off the grid, and they'd worry for your life and your well-being. But if you tell people, hey, this is what I'm doing and this is what's going on, it is absolutely possible.
You know, it's so crazy to me that like without your phone, you can actually just be a ghost.
It is very powerful. You know, people who go through digital Sabbaths, you know, they go off of technology for 24 hours. It's very, very powerful, and they love that feeling. They absolutely love it. Now, I consider it a hack, as noble as it is, I consider it a hack because, you know, it's great to have your phone off for one day a week, but the other 6 days a week, it's a hyperactive hive mind all over again. You tell a cigarette smoker to not smoke one day a week, that's just great, but the other 6 days, they're going to be hacking away. So, but what I find interesting with the digital Sabbath is people love that feeling so much. And what I argue is that, all right, for our professional lives, in some instances that isn't possible, but certainly for our personal lives, why isn't it possible? And I think it absolutely is.
Yeah, it's the highest form of dopamine addiction. And I'm pretty sure, tell me if I'm wrong, you know better than me. If you already have a dopamine addiction, that leaves you vulnerable to other dopamine addictions, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you have that kind of personality, for sure, in terms of having a more addictive personality, but when it comes to a smartphone, whether you're 2 years old or you're 94 years old, and I've seen it on both sides, it's constant, that constant urge. So yeah, I don't know if you're necessarily addicted to your smartphone, if it means necessarily you'll be just as addicted to a drug or another kind of substance. I'm not sure about the science behind that. But certainly in terms of the level of dopamine that's getting released and the constant need for it, truly the smartphone is the ultimate shortcut machine.
Yeah, and if you go through a detox, your adaptability or your ability to overcome resistance when it comes to dopamine, surely that strengthens that muscle to other vulnerabilities.
100% true, absolutely. And it also speaks to the financial investment. Like, you make the investment in terms of the smartphone, you're like, wow, if I can make this kind of difference in my life, let's say you have one too many drinks each week, I think you'd be like, okay, I've proven to myself that I can do this. And I think, yeah, it can improve other facets of life as well.
Richard, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm so happy I had this conversation because you've inspired me to turn this bloody thing off. So I'm going to prep for it. I always ask my guests, what's the best advice they've ever received? And I'm very interested to hear yours.
So it's a phrase I mentioned in the book, and it's something that I think is very powerful, and that is this phrase that, you know, there are so many things we don't know in life, but you know, truly our time in this world is a finite, non-renewable resource. And if we understand that our time in this world is a finite, non-renewable resource, we really have to analyze and evaluate how we're spending it. And all of a sudden, when you view it from that lens, that literally there is a ticker. And you can do this, like there's weird websites like this where you can put in like your BMI, you can put in all kinds of things. You can literally have a ticker of, you have 38 years and 27 days and 12 hours and 6 seconds. It's not a healthy thing in terms of, we should be more life focused, not death focused. But if you realize that truly that time is a finite, non-renewable resource, you are going to start thinking about how you're spending your time. I think in terms of the smartphone, that's one of the greatest arguments. So that's something that's very, very powerful to me, really resonates strongly with me. And in terms of advice, you know, how do you spend your time? Invest in meaningful things.
Yeah, I mean, you can get back 75 days a year with a click of a button.
Exactly.
That's absurd. Richard, where can we get your fantastic book and what is next for you?
Unplug, How to Break Up with Your Phone and Reclaim Your Life is available at all major booksellers, from Amazon to Target to Barnes & Noble to Walmart. Or if you're in New York City and you're a huge Rishi fan, I know there are plenty of Rishi fans, independent bookstores are also great. And there are plenty of great independents that are carrying this book as well.
Richard, thank you so much for coming on the show. It means the absolute world. I've learned so much, honestly. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.